I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Rabbi Malka Drucker. She's rabbi of Hamakom, the place for passionate and progressive Judaism, and we're here to talk about Hanukkah, which begins tonight. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So what is Hanukkah?
Hanukkah is an eight-day holiday about which very little is written, actually, in Jewish canon. And the reason for that is that while it is a wonderfully cheerful holiday and most loved by children, its story does not match the celebration. The story is actually quite bloody, and the rabbis didn't want to celebrate military victory, and rather not by might, not by power, by spirit alone. So that's rather than saying that the Maccabees were the heroes of this story, they wanted to focus on the miracle. And they wanted to basically downplay the holiday altogether. I mean, even spinning the dreidel, which was a gambling game, was something that they decided that they counted up the letters on the dreidel, because every letter has a numeric equivalent, and they discovered that it equaled the same as the numeric equivalent of the word Mashiach, Messiah. So they could tie it in. But basically, Hanukkah was, for the rabbis, a difficult holiday.
Would you like to at least tell us a little bit of the story and the miracle so that we know what bloody thing we're downplaying?
Yes. The story is that, and it can be found in Maccabees 1 and 2, that there was a time in history when Greek culture swept the world as the, essentially the, this was the model for the entire Western Hemisphere. And that included ancient Israel. And the Jews were always, always eager to embrace whatever is good and new, and certainly Greek culture that Alexander the Great had conquered the world with was what most Jews wanted to be part of. The problem was that the Assyrian king Antiochus was tired of the infighting between most of the Jews, who were pretty happy changing their names from Joshua to Jason and adopting Greek ways, and the small group that were, for the most part, in the countryside. So it was your urban Jews at that time who were the most assimilated, but the ones in the country really wanted to hold the hard line. The Assyrians wanted to put an end to the conflict between Jew and Jew. So one day they sent an emissary to a little village, Modi'in, outside Jerusalem, went to the most respected member of the community, Mattathias, and said, "You are very, very respected here, and if you would just eat this very small piece of pork, if you would kill this pig and just eat a little bit of it, and everyone else in your community could see you do that, that it would really serve you well. You would have a high position in the government." Mattathias was enraged, and as he was about to answer, someone comes up to the soldier and says, "I'll eat it. Give me the privilege." Mattathias, in his rage, kills the man who says this and the soldier, and says, "All who are for God, follow me." And that began the war that lasted 3 years. They fought hundreds against thousands.
What were they? I mean, they weren't fighting over bacon. I mean, what were they really fighting over?
A very, very, very good question. What they were fighting over was their identity. This was the first war for religious freedom. This was the first war that said that we want the right to be just who we are. I mean, because the Greeks, you know, at that time, you could be a Jew as long as you bowed to Zeus, but you couldn't be a Jew and do that. So they, circumcision was outlawed, the Sabbath was outlawed. So essentially, the tenets of Judaism were essentially outlawed as punishment, really, for this conflict within the people. What happened then was, after 3 years, somehow, because, you know, the miracle perhaps was that they won altogether. because they were so outnumbered.
I thought the miracle had to do with the oil in the lamp.
We're almost there.
Okay.
So 3 years later, they go back to the temple ready to celebrate and rejoice. They've reclaimed the temple, and they go in, and instead they weep because it's filthy and it's full of blood, and they've had, you know, wrestling, nude wrestling in it for years and all of that. And they see that there's just a drop of oil for what's supposed to burn all the time. They have just enough oil for one day. It's going to take 8 days to get more oil. We're going to light it. We'll light it and we'll see. And the story goes, it burned for 8 days. There are other understandings. They saw 8 spears on the ground. And those spears were left by the soldiers. And they turned them upright. And they made them into 8 separate lights to take these instruments of killing and now to sanctify them for a new purpose. Hanukkah means the rededication, the dedication to the tradition, but a rededication, a new understanding of what can happen when one goes against another. Now, the story goes on that those who won, the Maccabees, became as terrible as the oppressors. They went after the acculturated Jews. They went after everyone who didn't agree with them. So they became thugs in their power. So for the 10 minutes in world history the Jews had their own power, they became no different from anyone else. So it could be that the Jewish saving grace is that it's better not to have the power, which is part of the story of Hanukkah too. Because it's this very small group that survives and prevails against impossible odds that no one ever expected them to win. It wasn't. So the miracle really, to me, has often been that when the odds are so against you, that you don't give up.
I think that is a profound insight that is important to really talk about, which is, I mean, it's one thing if you're always the underdog, but when you're not the underdog, how do you use power in a manner that is kind, loving, and not exploitive and not murderous and all of that stuff? Which, I don't know, who's done a good job of that?
Well,
question mark.
If we move this to the moment, this is one of the great challenges for Israel, because this is a people that has been beleaguered and oppressed and persecuted, da da da, for so long that it becomes a position, a place. And then you find yourself, in fact, in a situation in Israel where, in fact, you're not the underdog. Not now. You know, it's not 1956.
And the exploitation of the Palestinian people is so horrifying that we can't even speak about the details of it on the radio. But back to Hanukkah. So how, given this history, how does that history factor into how it's celebrated today, if it does?
That Hanukkah has become really a very important holiday for most Jews, American Jews, is largely because of its proximity to Christmas. It's the time of year where everything's happening. And in 1980, when my first book came out about this, about Hanukkah, I went around giving talks how to hear the Shema when the Christmas bells are ringing, and
how to hear the what?
How to hear the Shema,
What's the
main credo? That's "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And I was very, very unequivocal. You know, look, this is not our holiday. Just because, I mean, birthdays are fabulous, but you can't just say, hey, David, I'm going to, you know, jump onto your holiday and celebrate your birthday like it's mine. So I was very unequivocal about this. It should be, for Jewish kids, this is what it is. And it shouldn't be necessarily equivalent. So that was 1980, so it's over 30 years ago. And I've come to see, you know, a very different world. And there's more intermarriage. There's more learning about different cultures, you know, than there was 30-some-odd years ago. So now I think that the importance of the holiday for Jews goes right back to its original meaning. it was a question of how to be acculturated, that is, how to take the very best from another group with whom you're living and still hold your own identity. Assimilation is giving that up. So that was the struggle then, and that is the struggle now, and maybe the miracle today is that I'm still here on your radio show talking about this, working this struggle out. And Hanukkah has become, for many, you know, I was just with my grandchildren, and they're just that age, you know, 9, 7, and 5, like, I want to celebrate Christmas. Why can't, I'll do Hanukkah, that's fine, but why can't I have Christmas too? You know, so, because it's not your holiday. I don't like being different. I live in Santa Barbara, and nobody is Jewish in my class except me. It's horrible every single day. Why do I have to be different from everybody else? And this is a very hard question to answer to kids about what this is about. But I think in some ways, as an American, there's so much conformity in this country, and there's so little allowance for being different, that I don't mind my grandchildren suffering a little bit around this question, because part of your identity is going to be, okay, I'm going to throw in my hat with these people. I'm really not entirely sure why, but I know, I mean, I love my parents and I love my grandparents, and they're kind of into this, and I respect them. And down the road, maybe I'll understand why I've had this deprivation when I was 7 years old. And I think that in some ways, it's like being kosher. The first lesson for me was, I just don't get to eat everything I want to eat. Well, I guess I just don't get to have everything that I want to have. That the first lesson is that it's different. It's different. So I think that that's part of what this teaching is for many, many Jews today, that Hanukkah becomes their time to assert their separate identity.
It's sort of ironic, isn't it, that here we are in the United States, which is probably the most multicultural society on the planet Earth, and we are less tolerant of difference? What does that even mean? Because we are all so different from one another.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I've, you know, with a lot of my friends here in town, I've encountered people who are on the left and really furious with Israel. It's an odd brush that can sometimes include Jews, not just Israel. So it's, and I've often been put in a place where, you know, what's the deal, Malka? Why, you know, like,
why are your people?
Yeah, what is this, your people? Yeah. And this is from people who have devoted their lives to indigenous people.
Right.
You know, so I said, but look, you know, I am part of, like, a primordial tradition, you know, and, you know, we've done a very nice dance of living in two worlds forever. But really, in many ways, this is what the whole story about Hanukkah is why not just say, hell, you know, Christmas carols are wonderful and the smell of the Christmas tree is fantastic, and it could just mean it's about peace on earth and nice things. It has nothing to do, you know, with that guy. And it feels to me that it's kind of like families. Like, you talk about your Italian background, I have my background, that there is in this, there is a higher intuition that we can trust, that there is value to belong to something. And I think that I feel good about being born into this long history.
It's interesting because I think, I mean, just thinking a lot about what you're saying, there is value in having multiple identities. And having multiple identities may be a way, or the way, that people come together across their differences. I mean, you're Jewish, you're American.
I'm a woman. There are a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely correct, that we are perhaps hardwired to be in the village. And we have many, many villages that we belong to. And this is one that's a difficult one for people to understand, even for Jews to understand. I mean, is it a religion? Kind of. Is it a race? I don't see how. I mean, we're everything genetically. So what are we? And I think the best word is what Mordecai Kaplan called, we are a civilization. We have a literature. We have an idea. We have a history. So all of that, you know, sort of, it feels good to be part of that. And as you say, Well, as Victor Hugo said, the more French I am, the more universal I am. So the more deeply I understand my root. We all find ourselves in the same place. You know, the root all starts from the same place. Sort of go off.
Interesting, yeah. And also, I mean, I think that the more secure people become in their identities, the less belligerent they are about their identities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that the more you... Yeah, well, my kids went to Jewish day school, and then they went to an Episcopal prep school, you know, later. They never had any difficulty with chapel twice a month or whatever it was. It was, you know, they knew who they were. So I think that that is part of it. The trick is to know who you are and what you're part of and not have a chauvinism, not have a... As you say, that insecurity that you need to feel that yours is better. That's the piece.
I think we have a lot to learn from our Native American brothers and sisters right here in New Mexico, which is there are so many people who just don't see any contradiction between their indigenous practices and Catholicism or whatever other religions they take on. They just do them both or do multiple things. Whereas I think we Westerners tend to say, well, if you do this, you can't do that.
Well, you know, you're right about that. I mean, all pagan religions allow for many gods and many different beliefs. Judaism, in truth, was the first one to really set up this monogamous relationship, even using the metaphor of marriage and the passion of it and all of that stuff. So that was really, they were really the one, you know, no, this is going to be the deal. There is nothing outside God. There is only God. That's what you're going to believe. That's what you're going to understand, that nothing falls outside it.
What does that mean? What do you mean by God?
Everything. Everything. That there's nothing else. There's nothing else. So in other words, it isn't like this is one that takes care of the sun and this takes care of the moon and this is a good one and this is a bad one. There's no organizing principle to it. You know? So this was sort of, in many ways, that's what Judaism sort of gave the world, the sovereign principle. There's one that encompasses, includes, is everything.
How is that different from science that says there's a big, huge universe that is made up of everything?
Maybe it doesn't. I mean, nothing goes away is also the notion. That everything is part of everything. And from that perspective, there's no death.
Well, there's biological death.
There's physical death. There's physical death. Yes, of course. Yet, if we're spirit, what dies?
So I guess that's one way in which it's different because from the scientific thing, because science doesn't acknowledge the existence of spirit.
Correct. Correct. Mystery, however. The acknowledgement of mystery. It's another name for God. Or intuition.
We're talking to Rabbi Malka Drucker about Hanukkah. Should we go back to Hanukkah?
Sure.
I mean, how is it celebrated? I mean, everybody's seen a menorah, and obviously we're speaking to Jews and Gentiles on this program, but I'm coming from a, let's say, a naive place. What actually happens on day one and day two through day eight?
That's a good question. One of the reasons that Hanukkah is so fabulous is you never have to go to the synagogue. You don't have to go to services. The whole thing is at home. And it's really open to so much creativity. The menorah itself, which is nine branches, not the seven that you'll see actually even in Catholic churches, as well as synagogues, is called a Chanukiah. It is not lit at sundown, the way all Jewish holidays are. It's lit when everyone is home and everyone is still awake. So from the oldest to the youngest, everyone is present for the light of the candles. You light one candle the first night. And you light them from right to left, as the Hebrew reads. And you're not allowed to, it actually says in the Talmud, count your coins by the light. The light should be used for no practical purpose. It should be put in the window to proclaim miracle. Miracle in this world, miracle in this life, that miracles happen. ordinary miracles, extraordinary miracles, they all happen. So you take the menorah after you light it, sometime when everybody's home and it's dark, put it in the window, then you have potato pancakes, latkes. The reason is the oil. And in Israel, jelly donuts for the same reason. Oily foods are what you eat to remember the miracle of the oil.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fried foods.
Totally. Absolutely fried foods. And then you get to play with the dreidel, which is this great little gambling game. And they figured out an acronym for the four letters on the dreidel, Nes Gadol Hayah Sham. A great miracle happened here. There. In Israel, it's here. And that's the whole thing. That's all. The menorah, the chanukah, could be made out of a potato. In the Holocaust, there's stories in Auschwitz how they took threads from their garments and they saved a little fat from their food to be able to light for Hanukkah. It could be a hammer, which is the Maccabee means hammer. It could be anything. And the as long as the ninth candle is set apart and it's higher, or in a different place, then it's kosher. So you can do anything you want. I once found my distributor cap for my 8-cylinder Buick was perfect for this. So,
and what about presents? Is that a kind of Christmas imitation, or is that part of it too?
Well, that's a very good question. There's a wonderful story by Shalom Aleichem called Hanukkah Geld, because I think it's on the fifth night. It was the custom to give a little bit of money, gelt, which is Yiddish, to students and teachers. And that was it. That was the whole thing. And the more religious you are, the less Hanukkah takes this gigantic, you know, like Christmas event. And again, I mean, many people tried to turn it into something each night, having a different theme. You know, so that's the problem of Hanukkah. It's so long. You know, and it's not so important. You know, so
it's long but not important. It doesn't happen in the synagogue.
Exactly.
You count your money and gamble.
Well, you don't count. You don't count your money, but yes, right. It's a night of play. So I think for children's perspective, that anything can go. You know, I mean, it's not like you're not allowed to handle money, which is on the Sabbath and all of that, and all these other rules. They're very few. I mean, it's just basically a very cheery holiday, and you're supposed to see the lights, and you sing, you know, this great song, Rock of Ages, you know, which talks about, you know, how you, despite everything, you know. So I think for kids, the little colored candles look like the soldiers, you know, the Maccabee soldiers, the heroes of this story. And I think, you know, again, I mean, as an American Jewish child growing up in the 50s, and I think it's still true that, you know, you sort of look at yourself, unless you're living in some closed Jewish community, in a world where you have very little, a very small presence. And here, this very small presence was able to prevail, was able to really push back and stand for what they believed, no matter what was going to happen, they knew that's what they had to do.
Now, if you were putting the menorah in your front window in a context of persecution or prejudice, you're basically, in some level, proclaiming, here we are.
Well, you wouldn't do it. I mean, you know, religion is to live by, not to die by, and not to antagonize by. So, actually, it's a wonderful story in Billings, Montana, about 15 years ago. There was anti-Semitism at this time of year. And the sheriff of Billings had everyone in that town, the newspaper printed the shape of a menorah, the big menorah, so that people could cut it out and they could put it in the window. So everyone in Billings, Montana put in, they said that, you know, it was really an amazing feeling of support that for the Jewish community there. Yeah.
Very interesting. Now, is there an element of it that is a solstice celebration, so that in the darkest time of the year we shine a light?
Yes. Again, the influence of the Greeks was that they would light bonfires at this time of year to rekindle the sun. So, and the Yule log also, which I guess the Christmas tree is an outgrowth of that. So again, the Festival of Lights, dark time of year. Hello, of course, we're all sort of on the same page.
Yeah, we're
page
all kind of the same. That's what you mean by the same roots.
Exactly. And we're even more than root, Mary Charlotte, I would say it's part of our spirit being revealed, too. The depression, the anxiety that sometimes comes, you know, when darkness falls. And that's the other piece of this. This is a story about when darkness seriously fell. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here, really, if that war hadn't been won. And it was a terrible, as I said, it was a terrible history for us. Yet, what do we make of this? It's not, you know, there is evil in the world. It's not all milk and cookies. How do you know when to push back? How do you know when it's an appropriate piece to do? How do you hold on to your own way of being and still benefit by those who are around you and hold this peace? I mean, these are very, you know, big questions, I think, for all of us. Most people in America, I think, don't have any idea. They can reinvent themselves every year when they find a new idea.
What do you mean?
Well, that we don't necessarily have even... In a country where we've had so much freedom and freedom from religion, that so many of us have come into the space without necessarily what guides us. You know, what if we had parents who weren't so profound and they didn't pass on even a wisdom tradition to us? So where are we going to learn the stuff of how to be? So I'm going to read a book. I'll learn a few things. But wait, this one's the bomb. You know, wait. I should serve. That's where my happiness will lie, in serving others. No, I'll read another book. It's going to tell me my happiness is going to lie in serving myself first. How will I know if I don't have a community and a wisdom tradition to continue to evolve the questions?
So, when you talk about this during your own services at your temple where you're the rabbi, do you give this out as an opportunity for contemplation for the people who are celebrating Hanukkah?
Absolutely. That there's no question that that every holiday exists in four worlds. In the world of action, you know, we get to eat latkes and, you know, do all this fun stuff. The deeper meanings are very important, and one of the most important teachings for me around this is the idea that at the beginning of creation, let there be light, first day, wow, separation begins right away. I mean, there's going to be a world, there has to be distinction. So there's going to be light, and there's going to be darkness. The fourth day, let there be a sun, moon, and stars. So the question has to be, what's the light of the first day? Because we only know it as physical light, right? So the light is understood to be the primordial light with which the world began. The light of creation. It's too intense, too fierce for us at this moment in time. So it's hidden away. It comes out at Hanukkah. It's one of the times that we experience it, that this light that will be in the world to come, however we understand it, maybe it's the light that we were talking about earlier, like, wow, we are one. That light, that peace, we get a glimpse of at Hanukkah, because the candles go from 1 to 8. Joy increases. The light is coming. And that I want to have a taste of it now, because I know I can't really be present for it most of the time. But that's what this time of the year is going to give me, a feeling of what it's going to be for me to have light inside me, not a fire of envy, not a fire of competition. That what is it like for me to feel myself as fire, which all of us are. To feel myself as light at this time of the year, and not the light of the gigantic blaze that the Greeks brought us, but that little light that grows each night and gets bigger and bigger. So that, I think, especially at this moment in time, where so many of us can barely get ourselves to read a newspaper, it's really important, I think, to get to that place of recognizing that we are where we are and that that light always exists. It's always there.
I think both fire and water are metaphors for almost anything you want them to be. And there is something about watching both fire and water. And I think of when you're a little kid and you have time to do that, like to watch a candle or to watch a log burning and to watch the manifestations of how that changes and grows and shrinks and comes back and all those kinds of things. It turns into a kind of poetry that is somehow related to the contemplations that you're talking about.
Oh, that's beautiful. It really is. Listen to this one, that the word shalom begins with a shen, and aish is fire. It ends with a mem, and mayim is water. In the middle is a lamed, which is looks like an L, and that's us. Between the two. Always held in that balance between the two. And we are both. Of course we're both.
Yeah.
We know that we're physically 98% water. That's the scientific perspective. I'm saying that we're also fire.
And that fire is what you call spirit.
Yeah.
We're talking to Rabbi Malka Drucker. I think it's really important that holidays are accessible to children and adults, and basically you can take the holiday on whatever level you're able to handle it. So here we are talking about spirit and fire and water and all these things, but we're also going to hear a song in a moment about potato latkes, which are also part of the whole thing.
That's right. And as with all Jewish holidays, food is a major component, and this holiday has particularly wonderful food. And part of the reason that we have food, we have latkes rather, as the main thing that we eat, is because, as we know, it's about the oil. Well, cheese and dairy also has a high fat content, and that's also connected to the story. And this is the story. This is a wonderful sort of perspective of women and their role, because Judith was a cousin of Judah Maccabee and wanted desperately to help in the war effort.
So wait, now we're going back to the...
the story.
The original story.
The original story. Original story is we're at 166 BCE, say, and here's Judah, you know, beleaguered, yet able to fight back Antiochus and his soldiers because he knows his land. He knows where the hiding places are. He knows how to outsmart the many Assyrian soldiers. His cousin, Judith, wants to help him. He says, make soup. Women don't fight, she said. I want to be part of this battle. So she knows that Holofernes, the chief Assyrian general, is mad for her. So she designs a plan one day to go to the tent of Holofernes, who is delighted to see her there, welcomes her in profusely. She's carrying a basket, and he wants to shower her with food and wine and everything. She said, look, I'm a Jew, and I eat a certain way, but I've brought enough so that I could entertain you. Would you eat what I have with it? Absolutely. She has a basket full of wonderful cheeses that are very salty and copious wine. He eats the cheese, and then he drinks the wine, and before you know it, Holofernes has passed out. He's asleep. She takes his sword. She beheads him. She puts his head in the basket and brings it back to her cousin Judah Maccabee to say, women can help. So that's the story of why we have dairy on Hanukkah. Yeah.
So I mean, when people say that the common thread in all religions is loving kindness, then you have stories like that.
Well, this is, if you've been to Florence, you see at the Uffizi.
I know.
That's the great...
Florence is you go to Florence and you think you're in the city of art and beauty and loveliness, and you go into any piazza and there's some beheaded marble statue of somebody having beheaded somebody else.
Well, there is a shadow. There is a shadow. And I always say that the Torah is a collective dream. It has everything in it. It's not history. It's not literature. It's a dream. It's a dream, and it needs to be read that way. And people see battles in there. It's the battle within. It's the Pharaoh within me. It's the Antiochus within me. It's also the part of me that has the courage not to give up. All those pieces are in the story so that I can see myself in that dream. So I think that that piece is very important too. But again, getting back to the pleasure of this holiday, which is most loved by children, this song by Debbie Friedman, I Am a Latke, is, I heard last year, she had done this concert for adults, and she said, look, I'm very tired, but I'll do one more song for you. So think of the one song that most opens your heart. And the audience unanimously shouted, I Am a Latke. So, and I think this, the reason is that Hanukkah, although it's part of the great joy of it is that sense of wonder in children. And it, I think it really, it awakens it in us. Whether we've had a Hanukkah to remember or not, we've been children. And we know what that sense of anticipation is before something and the joy of that moment, you know, and then the memory of it later. So I think that in a lot of ways that if we did nothing else during Hanukkah, but really tap into that part of us that believes still in miracles and plays, that it would be a great rededication to the part of ourselves that never grows old, that stays young.
Malka Drucker is the rabbi of Hamakom, a place for passionate and progressive Judaism here in Santa Fe. They are on the web at hamakomtheplace.org. That's spelled H-A-M-A-K-O-M, theplace.org. Thank you so much for being with us, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Isolde Kona Dovale. She is the author of the new book, Tales for Asti, 12 Stories to Read to Your Dog. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you're going to be doing a book signing at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 22nd of December at 2 in the afternoon. Now, the premise is a little funny. I mean, 12 Stories to Read to Your Dog, they don't understand what you're reading them.
You think so? Well, I thought about it after I published it. Why did I do that? And it came to me that maybe through my dog, I'm speaking to people. I can't speak to them directly. It might insult them. It might hurt them. And so maybe there is a message in each of these stories that I want to transfer to people, because, I mean, dogs have a special innocence that's unique to them, and I would like to also let people know that they are very special creatures, and they need our compassion. All creatures need our compassion, and of course, there are a lot of things out there that pain me. I come from Missouri, not originally, but I've lived there for 40-plus years, and we have all these puppy mills there.
Ah, yes.
And, of course, then I retired, and I came here, and I do see a lot of things that, again, pain me.
In terms of the way people treat animals.
In terms of the way, people treat animals, particularly here, and the different states have different laws, and New Mexico is quite lenient. I mean, you can cite somebody, but they never have to pay. And so I'm donating $1 from each book to the Humane Society, because I feel they really do something. They do take people to court.
Right. Now, the book is a bunch of stories, really from the dog's point of view.
Yes.
The different dogs in each story.
Yes. Yes. I mean, as I said, I'm speaking through the dog to people. I have no idea what my dog thinks. Probably the dog is a lot smarter than I am. I don't know. I know dogs. they operate primarily within spiritual realm, but they understand the world on some primal level. The humans in their lives maybe do not. I don't know.
You set these stories in lots of different places.
Yes. I have traveled a lot, and I think the different countries... I have not been to Siberia. The January story, it's 12 stories, one for each month. The January story takes place in Siberia. I have not been in Siberia. I have been to the other places, Japan, that's the December story, Italy, Germany, Haiti, Argentina, Nigeria, Finland, and the American Southwest.
Were you observing dogs in each of these places? Were you
no.
thinking about... No, okay.
No, I wasn't thinking at all about dogs in the places. But when I read, I think about what would a dog do in that particular situation, for instance. How can a dog contribute? And that's the May story, which is the Argentina story, the Madres. I don't know if you know about the Madres. In the 1980s, children were kidnapped by the military
right.
in the dirty war.
Right.
And the Madres are still walking around the Plaza de Mayo. That's the May story now. And so I read in the paper there in Buenos Aires that a family was reunited using DNA analysis. And so I said, well, I wonder if a dog could identify a child after many years. The problem is that the time that has passed takes
yeah,
two generations.
Exactly. I mean, there's no dog alive now.
Right. And so I was a scientist, biochemist, geneticist, and so on. So I looked into this, and I touched upon epigenetics and transgenerational inheritance. And so I searched the literature, and I came across a world expert in Tel Aviv. And I told her about this idea I had, and she said, oh, yes, that's definitely possible.
And so that's
and
the
so that's the May story.
So the book is called Tales for Asti. Now, who is Asti?
Asti was my first dog, and I started these stories 15 years ago. Of course, it's a dachshund. The dachshund sleeps in my bed, and it was a Sunday morning, and I wanted to stay in bed. I didn't want to get up at 6, but she nudged me, and so I looked around, and in my bedroom, I have all big Haitian paintings, paradise, and all kinds of things. And so I looked around, and one painting had a cock, a rooster. And so I said, okay, Doc, I'm going to tell you a story. And that's the November story about Haiti and the pompous cock. And so I finally got up, and I told a friend of mine, she said, you have to write these stories down.
Now, did the dog look like he was paying attention?
You always have to put a word in between that the dog knows, for instance, her name, or just a word they recognize. I mean, your dog knows, I don't know how many words.
I don't know how many words. Walk, dog food.
Yes.
Their name.
Yes. Or
good,
hungry.
Good dog,
yes.
Bad dog.
Right. You have to put this in between, otherwise they get restless.
Right.
So, yeah, she did listen, and I guess she left me in peace. So.
The book is called Tales for Asti, 12 Stories to Read to Your Dog by Isolda Cona Dovale, who will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 22nd of December at 2 o'clock. And so these are stories for dogs, for dog owners, maybe for kids, or dog lovers of any kind.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed the interview. I was worried about it, but I enjoyed it. Thank you.